My name is Robin Freeman, and I'm one of the 8 members of the 7th year of the Cowan Fellows Human Rights Study Project. I'm going to start just by taking a few minutes to introduce the other members and then give you a brief introduction of the project and of our research trip to Cambodia. After this very short introduction, each of us is going to give you a brief synopsis of our individual research and experiences in Cambodia. And we ask that if you have any questions, you hold them until after we've all presented. So the 2008-2009 Cowan Fellows are Zach Williams, Dana Jupiter, Pamela McElroy, Guillermo Hover-Cataldi, Kathleen Ho, Kathleen Doherty, and Gabe Walters. And we'd also like to recognize the members of next year's group who are in attendance today. If you could just stand up or give a little wave when I call your name. Rob Sherman, Jen Nelson, yay, Pat Mott, Dan Perrell, Emily, there's Dan, sorry. Emily Higgs, Kristen Voorhees over there, and Lauren Willard in the back. And Joelle Perry is the 8th member, and she is studying abroad in Israel right now. I'd also like to thank our faculty advisors for all of their support over the last year. It's Barbara Armacost, Carrie Abrams, Mimi Riley, Jem Ryan, Julia Mahoney, and Ann Coughlin. And we are especially grateful to Dina Hurwitz, our group faculty advisor, for all of her advice and support. Hey, thanks, Dina. Today's presentation marks the end of our year-long research project. Last spring, the 8 of us were selected by last year's Cowan Fellows, and as a group, we decided to spend the year focusing on human rights in Cambodia. We traveled to this small Southeast Asian country for 2.5 weeks in December and January to conduct investigative on-site field research in 8 different human rights topics. Cambodia is a fascinating country home to 14 million people. We were based in Phnom Penh, the capital city, and which is we found to be very vibrant and bustling, filled with very kind people and tons of interesting things to do. Cambodia, though, has had a tumultuous history. It was a protectorate of France from 1863 to 1953, and upon gaining independence, it became a constitutional monarchy. During the Vietnam War, the U.S. bombed and briefly invaded Cambodia, and in 1975, the communist Khmer Rouge took power. This regime, led by Pol Pot, evacuated the cities and sent the entire population on forced marches to rural work projects. It attempted to create an agrarian society where intelligence and education were punished, Western medicine discarded, and schools, libraries, and temples destroyed. From 1975 to 1979, between 1 and 3 million Cambodians out of a total population of 8 million died from executions, overwork, starvation, and disease. During our trip, we had a chance to visit the Tuol Sleng Genocide Museum. This building was a high school that was turned into a prison and a torture chamber by the Khmer Rouge. 17,000 people were taken there, and of those, only 12 survived. The man who ran this prison is known as Doik, and he is the first person to go on trial at the Khmer Rouge Genocide Tribunal in Phnom Penh, and his trial started just last week. In 1978, Vietnam invaded Cambodia to take power from the Khmer Rouge and stop the genocide. Vietnam occupied Cambodia until a peace settlement was reached in 1991. This period of occupation was fraught with violence and warfare between the Vietnamese and the Khmer Rouge, and the rest of Cambodia, was caught dangerously in the middle. Today, Cambodia's problems reflect this violent history. It is one of the poorest countries in Asia, and it suffers from institutional and rampant corruption, a pervasive mistrust of and discrimination against the Vietnamese, deforestation and forced land eviction, landmines that still cover areas of the country, and a frustratingly weak rule of law. Despite our focus on these and other serious problems, we found a lot to enjoy in Cambodia. There's been a significant amount of international attention focused there that has led to important advancements in human rights. Perhaps the most visible of these is the Khmer Rouge Tribunal that has attempted to give a voice to the millions affected by the Khmer Rouge regime. Nevertheless, Cambodia has a long way to go. One metaphor we heard was that the country was like a rebellious teenager. After the Vietnamese occupation ended in the early 1990s, a flood of international aid organizations entered the country, and it has just been recently, 15 or 20 years later, that the government and Cambodian-run organizations have attempted to take back control and assert their independence. With essentially no experience in self-rule, Cambodia can expect to stumble more than a few times. Without a doubt, the people of Cambodia are its best asset. They are kind and respectful. A woman that Dana and Kathleen met invited them to attend her cousin's rehearsal dinner after she had to cut short a meeting. And I think that was a pretty interesting experience for them. The people are also curious and entrepreneurial. Several of us had lunch with a single mom who wanted us to tell her everything we knew about marketing and what she could do to attract more tourists to come have lunch at her restaurant. But most of all, the people are hopeful. They prefer to look forward to a future of opportunity rather than concentrate on their troubled past. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Zach to tell you a little bit about the criminally accused.
Thanks, Robin. Like Robin said, my name is Zach Williams, and as you can tell by my clunky and inartful, artless title, I studied the position or the criminal justice system in Cambodia, particularly the provision of legal counsel, of defense counsel to the criminally accused. Cambodia is the big in its system, which I'll lay out and explain in a measure of detail in a few minutes, rests a great deal, rests very heavily on having that's a practice run. So the way Cambodia's system is set up, basically any criminal justice system, anywhere you find, it's very important that lawyers proceed along through the case alongside the criminally accused. Most accused persons in this world aren't well versed in human rights conventions and constitutional protections, so that's why we rely on attorneys. It's especially important in the Cambodian system, which is adapted from the French civil system, which I'll explain a little bit, that attorneys, the right to counsel attaches and attorneys and legal services are delivered very early on in the process. That's the most important need. The very just implementation of the system rests almost, I wouldn't say entirely, but very strongly on that need. And the problem is, the nasty, unfortunate irony is, that's Cambodia's biggest weakness. Its biggest problem is not so much government repression or a bloodthirsty government that's after causing problems for criminal defendants. It's just there's not a lot of lawyers there. So I don't want to spend too much time on the international standards, but I've mentioned in the title of my paper the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights and the Constitution of Cambodia. Those and a few other national and international documents provide the basis for the protections that most criminal defendants, that all criminal defendants have. And there's no need to go through those in detail, but they're very familiar for anyone who's watched Perry Mason or Law and Order or what have you, or read a John Grisham novel or seen a John Grisham movie, which we all know are better than novels anyway. So everyone is entitled to an attorney throughout the proceedings, a judge who decides cases and considers cases independently and free from bias. Everyone's entitled to a few procedural guarantees, a high burden of proof, the ability to examine witnesses, and everybody's also guaranteed the right not to have their confession coerced. The way Cambodia implements these, or would implement these rights in practice, is a little bit different than what we do here. Again, anybody who's watched, whether you're a law student or any of those non-lawyers out there, every American knows that trials are the high point of our system. So there's investigation period, but then two sides bring to bear the evidence that they put in front of a judge who enforces the rules of the court, enforces the law, and a jury who decides facts and the disposition of cases. And that's where all the heat is in the Western, in the Anglo-American system. It's a little bit different in the civil law countries. There's still investigation period, investigation hearings, and then a trial and appeals, but it's really the investigation where all the action happens. The handing down of the indictment in the civil law system is not as certain as a guilty conviction at trial, but it's pretty close. the judges go out and do their own investigations along with their clerks, And that's where they dispose of the cases most of the time. If you are indicted in the criminal system in a civil law country, the trial is more of just an accounting of the facts. So to continue the analogy, having no lawyer during the investigation period in Cambodia is somewhat like having no lawyer during the trial in the Western system. Basically, you're up a creek without a paddle if that happens. And here's the rub. The problem is that Cambodia just has very few lawyers. Lawyer jokes are real popular in this country, but we don't know what it's like to live in a society where there's no one to defend you. If a policeman happens to arrest you for a crime that you didn't commit, or if a judge wants to sentence you for 20 years in prison for snatching a purse or something like that. Lawyers are great when viewed from that perspective. When the Khmer Rouge were forced from power, there were about 10 attorneys left in Cambodia. As Robin said, the Khmer Rouge targeted people of training, and no matter what you think about lawyers, we are included in that group. So there are only about 10 left. During the Vietnamese rule, there was no development of attorneys because it was police rule, so you don't need attorneys when you just do what you want as a government. And then since independence, there's been some movements in development of attorneys, but it's pretty slow. I guess the best that for a country of 14 million, there's 650 members of their bar association. Half of those members of bar association who've bought their way in, who've bought a law degree or a certification, only about 300 attorneys for a city or for a country of 14 million. It's like one attorney for the whole city of Charlottesville. You can imagine the mess that comes in with that. So in cases where there are attorneys, it makes a huge difference. If you have an attorney during an investigation, it's far more likely, and the very few numbers that there are bear this out, it's far more likely that the policeman will not beat you or coerce you to confess. The leading criminal defense NGO in Cambodia claims a 30% acquittal rate. I don't know, there's no numbers on what the acquittal rate is for cases where there are no attorneys, but it's not 30%. I'll just tell you that. It's definitely not that. In cases where defendants have no attorney, they will stay in jail for up to 2 or 3 years before their case goes to trial. There was one case that throughout the beginning of the proceedings through the end of appeal, this person was in jail 7 years. That one NGO found that a case where the person had been in jail 7 years to the conclusion of his appeal. Well, he may not have had a seven-year sentence for whatever crime he was found guilty of. In those cases where there's an attorney, the length of detention lowers to around 3 months, which is perfectly justifiable. So Cambodia has a lot of different NGOs. You'll hear about a lot of different NGO models as you hear all these presentations. But the public advocacy model of asking the government to enforce rights may not work for the criminal system. Money may be best spent just developing attorneys and hoping that the enforcement of rights and from case to case builds up the culture of human rights in the criminal system going forward. So I thank you for all your time, and I'm going to pass off to Dana Jupiter.
So I originally went to Cambodia thinking that I was going to research prevention programs that focus on girls' education in an effort to combat trafficking. And what I realized when I got there is that you can't study trafficking without looking at the commercial sex industry as a whole. There are no reliable statistics on the trafficking problem in Cambodia or really anywhere in the world, but it's clear that it is a significant problem that isn't getting any better. But unlike most of the horror stories about trafficking that you'll see in the newspaper or on TV, the way that trafficking happens in Cambodia is less of a sensational phenomenon and more grounded in cultural norms and practices that exploit women's vulnerability through existing social relationships. In a country like Cambodia where prostitution is legal, one of the biggest challenges is distinguishing between voluntary sex workers and people who are trafficked into sexual exploitation. The difficulty in doing that has a lot to do with just how complex trafficking is and the varying degrees of consent that can exist at different points in a migration process. And in Cambodia, that's the line between voluntary and involuntary migration is even less clear because of how trafficking occurs through existing social relationships and cultural practices. But the inability to distinguish between voluntary sex workers and individuals trafficked into sexual exploitation also can be attributed to the governing legal and policy framework. The UN Trafficking Protocol, which was drafted in 2000 as a supplement to the Organized Crime Convention, approaches trafficking from a criminal justice perspective. So there's a lot of emphasis on prosecution and not a lot of emphasis on victims' rights. The protocol doesn't define victim, and it doesn't require states to identify victims. So what that means is that governments like Cambodia that have criminalized trafficking pursuant to the protocol also don't define victim and don't have set victim identification procedures. The other major part of this framework is U.S. anti-trafficking policy. And that's because U.S. basically appointed itself to be treaty monitoring body. When Congress passed the Trafficking Victims Protection Act in 2000, that requires the Secretary of State to annually report on other governments' anti-trafficking efforts. And there's a three-tier ranking scale based on minimum standards that were created by the U.S. The biggest problem, well, there are many problems with the system, but one of the biggest ones is that at the center of it is an anti-prostitution policy. The U.S. government has sort of adopted a moral crusade against trafficking that includes claims like prostitution causes sex trafficking. And even though that there's no research to support those kind of claims, there are standards that countries are measured against that include things like the degree to which they are trying to get rid of a commercial sex industry, even if prostitution is legal in that country. And the U.S. has also conditioned funding for organizations that do anti-trafficking work in other countries on a requirement that they basically pledge that they don't support or advocate or do any work that goes towards the legalization of prostitution or the practice of prostitution. And the way that the United States has sort of been able to influence other countries is especially problematic in a country like Cambodia for a couple reasons. The first is that the commercial sex industry in Cambodia is well established and culturally ingrained in their society. Prostitution has never been illegal in Cambodia, and there's no desire for it to be. The fact that men visit sex workers is considered completely normal. There was a director of one of the NGOs that I met with who had taught at the law school in Phnom Penh beforehand told me that he would ask his students what they thought about the statistic that 70% of Cambodian men lose their virginity to prostitutes. And he said that men and women, students, would say that that seemed accurate and not a problem. A second reason why it's problematic is that associating prostitution and sex trafficking puts the commercial sex industry in a realm of unacceptable social behavior that reinforces discriminatory practices against sex workers and also problematic cultural attitudes towards women in general. Even though the commercial sex industry itself is completely accepted in Cambodia, sex workers are stigmatized and discriminated against. And the anti-prostitution approach to trafficking increases the stigma against sex workers by condemning them for what they do for a living. And then with respect to women in general, the belief that the commercial sex industry is a necessary part of Cambodian society has to do with stereotypical ideas about male and female sexuality. And I think the easiest way to sort of explain these is with two Khmer proverbs. One is, 10 rivers are not enough for one ocean, and men are like gold, women like cloth. The first one describes the belief that men's sexual desire is insatiable and cannot be fulfilled by one woman. The second explains the importance of women's sexual purity. While men can be wiped clean, women, once sullied by sexual indiscretion, are permanently stained. The anti-prostitution approach to trafficking reinforces the idea that women's sexuality should be controlled by society because a woman's value is tied to her virginity. And the underlying assumption under this anti-prostitution approach that women can't choose sex work reinforces traditional cultural norms that deny women control over their own lives. The ideal Cambodian woman doesn't think for herself, but follows what she's told to do by her husband, by her parents, by anyone who is above her on the strict social hierarchy in Cambodia. And traffickers take advantage of those cultural norms that tell women not to question or challenge people above them, to use existing social relationships to recruit women and girls into the commercial sex industry. So the anti-prostitution approach to the problem actually makes women more vulnerable because it reinforces the traditional disempowerment of Cambodian women by denying their ability to choose a profession. And the third and final reason that the pressure that the U.S. can exert on other countries is such a problem in Cambodia is that it precludes Cambodia, the government of Cambodia, and organizations working inside Cambodia from taking any affirmative actions that could be seen as supporting prostitution, such as extending labor laws to voluntary sex workers. Contrary to the assertions that prostitution causes sex trafficking, research actually shows that legalizing prostitution reduces trafficking because it allows governments to regulate the industry. And under the right conditions, legal prostitution can improve workers' safety and health and ability to control their own working conditions. And even though prostitution is already legal in Cambodia, those right conditions don't yet exist. The anti-prostitution approach to trafficking pushes the commercial sex industry further underground and pushes the women who work in it further outside the protections of society. And a superior approach to combating trafficking would focus on the root socioeconomic causes and would work on improving the conditions of women who are voluntarily in the sex industry and regulating that industry so as to better be able to identify the women who are not there voluntarily. The solution is not as simple as simply extending the labor laws to the sex industry, obviously, but being able to take that first step is something that Cambodia needs to be able to do without worrying about negative repercussions on the international stage. So, thank you, I'll pass it on to Pam.
Okay. My research focused on the access to citizenship and residency among the ethnic Vietnamese, but I'm actually going to talk only about citizenship right now because it was really much easier to pare it down to one thing for this presentation. The ethnic Vietnamese communities have a very long-standing presence in Cambodia. They've traditionally lived along rivers where they established floating fishing communities, and that's actually what that picture is. It's a floating fishing community. But they also have land-based communities throughout Cambodia. Their exact number is unknown, but they're definitely a minority. The estimates suggest that of the people of Khmer ethnicity, which is the dominant majority ethnicity in Cambodia, make up about 95% of the population. So everybody else is within that just remaining 5%. And to understand the issues facing that community, you really have to know a little bit about the history between Vietnam and Cambodia. I don't have time to give a great history, but I can say that there's a very old, deep-seated racial animosity between the two countries, and that animosity really played out very dramatically during the time of the Khmer Rouge. Part of the Khmer Rouge's goal was to take Cambodia back for the Khmer. Like, that's what they said they were doing. And so the Vietnamese were vilified in propaganda, and they were specifically targeted and killed at that time. The Vietnamese, as Robin mentioned earlier, actually removed the Khmer Rouge from power, and they set up a government that ruled until 1991. And while they were there, they were viewed as this foreign, hostile, occupying force, which they were in part, but there was definitely a lot of the same racial animosity underlying the way they were seen at the time. Now, beginning in the late 90s, a report surfaced that large groups of ethnic Vietnamese people whose families had been in Cambodia for generations were stateless, meaning that there was no country that actually recognized them as citizens. But there was no consensus among international governing bodies or NGOs as to whether there was actually a problem. It really wasn't clear whether the nationality law or the constitution of Cambodia extended the possibility of citizenship to ethnically Vietnamese people, and various treaty monitoring bodies and NGOs actually issued reports that differed in their conclusions during this time and for years after. So the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights guarantees the rights of individuals to a nationality, and Cambodia is a party to the ICCPR. So if these people were stateless, there was definitely a problem. And the focus of my research initially I wanted to look at whether there was this issue of statelessness and to try to identify the reasons for the lack of consensus on the problem. Okay, to make a long story short, I actually don't think that most of the ethnic Vietnamese in Cambodia are stateless in the most technical sense of the term. Based on a number of interviews and on recent statements by the Vietnamese government, I think that they would be recognized as Vietnamese citizens if they saw that recognition. But I also think that conclusion doesn't really sufficiently address their practical problems. They ultimately, even if they're not stateless, ethnic Vietnamese individuals aren't being granted the same level of access to Cambodian citizenship as individuals from other ethnic groups. So just to give you one example, I actually, and there are numerous examples, but I spoke with one woman who told me about local government officials working with the police who were in charge of implementing efforts to make sure everyone was registered and identified with the government. So her village had a Vietnamese section and a Khmer section, and government officials informed the people in the village that they came and they told them they needed to pay these officials and that the officials would return with new identity documents for them. This was a fairly common thing to do because documentation was lost during the previous years because of all the changes in government and that kind of thing, so it wasn't really a strange thing. However, the Vietnamese villagers were charged 30 times more than the Khmer villagers. And when the government officials returned, they came with documents only for the Khmer villagers, not for the Vietnamese ones. And none of the Vietnamese complained, obviously, because these were the government officials. So, I mean, who were they going to complain to? And the fact is, there was, Dana mentioned a lack of data with regards to sex trafficking. There's the same thing with this whole situation. It's very difficult to get a handle on the exact like scope and numbers of the problem. But that story didn't seem to be an isolated instance of government corruption. It seemed the anecdotes are numerous enough and from varying parts of the country that it seems like the law actually is denying Vietnamese equal access to citizenship in a discriminatory manner. And that does, in fact, place Cambodia in violation of its obligations, at least under the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, or ICERD. ICERD requires state parties to review governmental, national, and local policies and to remedy those policies where they create or perpetuate racial discrimination. And that includes laws relating to nationality when those laws are discriminating on the basis of nationality, which seems to be what's happening in this case. And now, the lack of access to citizenship can have really, really big practical consequences in Cambodia. For children, it will affect their access to education, and for adults, it affects their access to work, to the ability to own property, and to access the judicial system. And then more generally, I think on a kind of a more abstract level, it actually contributes to the greater ethnic animosity because it contributes to the problem of Vietnamese people not being seen as part of Cambodia and not feeling that they're part of Cambodia, even though they've been there for generations, and ultimately not having the opportunity to actually be part of Cambodia by participating in the political process and that sort of thing. And those types of concerns were part of what motivated the international community to recognize a right to nationality in the first place. So even if the statelessness framework doesn't directly apply, well, that might be arguable, there are concerns underlying the right to nationality that are definitely implicated by the discriminatory application of the nationality law. It's the nationality law of times, I hope that made sense. These concerns seem to underlie the lack of consensus about statelessness that I found in my research before going to Cambodia. That it seemed to me that when I spoke, especially to non-lawyers at NGOs, and they told me that the Vietnamese were stateless, what they were trying to express was really that idea. It was like a colloquial way to say that these people had been in Cambodia for a long time. This was the only state that really mattered to them, and that they weren't legally considered members of the state. Now, the whole problem of access to citizenship is pretty complicated, and it isn't completely addressed by just trying to force the government to apply the nationality law consistently and equally, because the underlying racial animosity and the lack of trust between the Vietnamese and Cambodians would still exist. So, in fact, actually, there were publicized efforts to try and get Vietnamese children registered at birth and that sort of thing, and they led to large public outcry and threats of violence. So ultimately, efforts to help the Vietnamese in Cambodia claim their legal rights are going to have to, they'll have to be supported by changes in social attitudes. ICERD, I think, can be used to force the government to cooperate in trying to effect those changes. For example, one NGO that I met with had been able to introduce a curriculum discussing ethnicity into grade schools, taking advantage of the fact that the Cambodian government wanted to be able to point to things saying, we are actually trying to comply with ICERD, we are trying to fulfill our obligations under the treaty. And that may seem like a small thing, but everyone I spoke to in the NGO community said that the existence of the organization that I was talking to, which was led by Cambodians of various ethnicities, and it was aimed at addressing these ethnic tensions, was a big step in Cambodian society, that wouldn't have taken place, you know, years ago. That organization wouldn't have existed. So in the end, I mean, this may not be the most positive message, but I think that they're, that sort of slow, consistent social efforts are going to be the key to ultimately creating this environment where the ethnic Vietnamese are allowed equal access to citizenship and to the rights that come with citizenship. So that's that. And next is Guy.
Hello, my name is Guillermo Jover-Cataldi. I'm a second-year student, and I focused on land rights in Cambodia. Given the brief time that we have, I just want to give you a quick overview of how this issue became so pervasive in Cambodia today and what it looks like on the ground. Land grabbing and forced evictions are probably Cambodia's biggest human rights issue right now in the sense of pervasiveness and prevalence. Reports mention about one out of every 20 Cambodians are involved in a land dispute at this very moment. Now, land grabbing and forced evictions become a human rights issue through two covenants that Cambodia has signed and agreed to. One of them is the International Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which has already been mentioned, and the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, which Zach talked about briefly. Both of these international instruments establish a right to an adequate standard of living and adequate housing for all the citizens of the world, and especially those of signatory countries. They also establish certain parameters that countries have to meet and things that they have to guarantee to their citizens, including not just a house to live in, but also a way to make a livelihood and sustain their families. Now, Cambodia's land problem can be understood better if one looks a little bit at the past and the historical events that have led to the situation that we have today. Throughout Cambodia's history, land tenure has been a very informal system, a very informal process. Basically, determining possession of a property depended on arrangements that you had with your neighbors, on very informal, sometimes comical, physical limits between properties. So a tree or a hammock that they hung would be a fence between two pieces of land. This is a very deep-rooted tradition in Cambodian culture, especially considering that it's an overwhelmingly agrarian society. Still to today, they still use 13th century technology for a lot of their agriculture, fish traps and fish nets that you'd see in some movies about, you know, the old Angkor Empire. During the Khmer Rouge regime, the collectivization of land was prevalent, of course, and there was absolutely no private property. In fact, even currency was forbidden. There was no money to speak of. On top of that, there were massive displacements of huge populations from their hometowns to very, very far away different places of the country. Some were taken to border camps. Others were taken to internment camps. A lot of the men were mobilized into the Khmer Rouge forces. 3 million people disappeared or were killed. So a lot of those roots that were really at the basis of land tenure in Cambodia were destroyed. Excuse me. After this kind of sandstorm during the Khmer Rouge regime, the dust began to settle a little bit, and the new government decided that in order to promote economic development, it needed to solve the confusion that there was regarding land tenure. So it began this very haphazard, sometimes very random system of assigning land to people that were far away from their hometowns. A lot of these people could not go back. They had no means to get back to their homes. Some of them had nothing to go back to. Their land had been scorched, their houses destroyed, their families killed. Some of them had been replaced by other people. Families took in other people moved into the land, so they had really nothing to go back to. So the government began this redistribution of land that was really added more confusion to the mix, just because there was actually no written titles being given out, or very few of them were given out. So most of the people were pointed to a piece of land, told to go there with permission of the government, and that's exactly what they did. Now, something to keep in mind is that corruption is rampant within the Cambodian government and the state apparatus. Influence trafficking has become a major issue. So the people that have the economic power to buy themselves political favors do it often. And those that don't are often left with the burden. So in 2001, in an attempt to to formalize this chaotic system, Cambodia passed a land law and several confusing and often very contradictory sub-decrees on specific issues. Now, there were two provisions that are key to understanding the land right issue, the land right problem in Cambodia that are within this land law. One of them is the fact that it established possession as a way to gain ownership. So if you've been on the land for 5 years before the land law was passed, if you had continuous possession of it, if it was open and notorious, very similar to possession law as in the United States, you could gain ownership and title to that land. Another very important aspect was the land concession mechanism. Land concessions are big tracts of land given out by the government for one of two purposes, either for social purposes, which are given to people that need the land for habitational purposes or to gain sustainability, or economic purposes, which is land given out to usually big corporations or big economic interests to develop and exploit that land. These two concepts seem to be at a conflict in Cambodia right now, and that seems to be at the root of the problem. It is much easier for a big corporation to get a land concession and obtain land that way than it is for individual citizens to obtain land through possession. What this land law in effect did, it was meant to clarify and organize land tenure in Cambodia. What it really did was it superimposed this formal system of laws and regulations on the already existing traditional customary system of land tenure, the traditions that people had, the neighborly relations. So instead of one prevailing over the other, which was, I guess, the expected idea, what happened was you had a dual system. You had different actors playing the same game by different rules. I think I wanted to do two cases to illustrate this problem. Sorry, I don't know why that went there. Two cases to illustrate the problem, but I'll just go for one, which is kind of the more dramatic one. This takes place in the urban landscape of Phnom Penh. It's a 3.6 hectare tract of land, and so it's roughly 8 or 9 acres. It is right in front of the National Assembly of Phnom Penh, which is a newly developing area of the city. There's big buildings going up, major developments. There were, about 2 years ago, there were still about 1,000 families living there, about 5,000 people. Hun Sen, who's been the prime minister of Cambodia since the Vietnamese came in, he made a campaign promise that he would make that area a social land concession. He would give them to the people. He would invest government funds to build an apartment complex, some stores. These are very poor people. They are tuk-tuk drivers. They have stalls in market, things like that. However, this promise was never in writing except for a letter of intent. The land law does create a mechanism for land concessions, which the government did not follow. However, the people there, mostly illiterate, believed him, and they agreed that this was their land now. They had been there since the 1980s. They turned that, it was a swamp land, they turned it into what it is today. They cleared the land of trees. They filled it with red sand, red land. The community name is Day Kahorn, which means red land in Khmer. About 5 years ago, what happened was 7NG, a development company, kind of an economic powerhouse in Cambodia, began to notice that that land was worth a little bit of money. In fact, the 3.6 acres was worth $44 million. So it began a very slow and very covert effort to remove the families and gain access to that land. It quickly got an economic land concession on land that had already been conceded through its mechanisms within the government. Throughout the years, there have been negotiations, endless negotiations between the citizens and residents of Day Kahorn with 7NG. There has been violence until about a week before we went to Cambodia. There were still 150 families there. The rest had been moved to relocation camps, very precarious ones outside the city, from which these residents could not access their jobs. So they had to get new jobs. They had to uproot their lives and change everything they knew. The 150 families left were the holdouts in a way, but they were the ones that had been convinced by the NGOs that they had rights, they had legal claims to this land, that they should not leave unless they were duly compensated, which is what the law calls for. Compensation was offered, but it was about a half at the market price, and the families refused to leave. About 2 days before we left, there was an ultimatum from the government saying, take the money now or we bulldoze tomorrow. The day we left, the citizens of Day Kahorn convened a press conference stated that they needed more time to discuss this with their families. They needed time to do it. The government gave them some sort of a moratorium, I guess, for a couple of days. But about 3 or 4 days after we left Cambodia, I get an email from the Phnom Penh Post, which is the newspaper that I'm subscribed to. And the front page story is that overnight, the whole Jacob Horn community was bulldozed down to the ground. And the pictures are absolutely horrifying. People crying, babies in mother's arms running away. So it has a very real impact, this issue, on the lives of citizens that are already in need. Today, the community residents, the 150 families that were there when the bulldozing began, are pretty much living on the hallways of NGO offices. NGOs have rented homes for them, and they're trying to sustain them. They have absolutely nothing left. None of their belongings were able to be extracted from the site. Armed guards are protecting that whole area right now. And you can expect to see some townhomes and some luxury office space there in about 3 or 4 years. I think that case illustrates more than any other the way things have been handled with land rights in Cambodia. It has been very dramatic. It has been heart-wrenching for a lot of families there. And there is a shadow government taking control of this issue right now. Land grabbing, the scope of it, and the speed at which it's progressing makes it very difficult to be optimistic about the outlook of this issue. The more development that takes place in Cambodia, the more the government will be able to be independent from NGO funding and international organizations. Once that happens, there's really no one left to protect these people. Right now, the only ones advocating on their behalf are NGOs. And the less power they have, the more trouble these people will be in. So while I'm a very optimistic person in general, it was very tough for me to to look at this and say, okay, there is a future here, there is a lot of hope, because frankly, there isn't. I guess what the people there were stating is, we're hoping for a miracle. We're hoping for somehow someone to stop this train, because it is moving at the speed and the power of a train. This thing is sweeping the country. There's not one province that hasn't been affected by this issue. This case was an urban case, but the rural cases are also just as serious, and some of them are actually even worse, just because people in the countryside, they really have nothing else to do but farm. And in order to farm, the one thing you need is land. So it's a very serious situation. Hopefully something will come along that will change it. But unfortunately, it's my duty to report that the outlook is quite bleak. Thank you for your time. Next is Kathleen Ho.
I tend to gesticulate, so I'm afraid that I'm going to hit that. So many of you are probably wondering, how does microfinance relate to human rights? Microfinancing is a bunch of financial services. It's loans, deposits, money transfers, basically bank stuff. What does that have to do with women's rights, access to health care, or the right to education? And the link lies in access to finance. Microfinance basically gives previously considered unbankable people financial services that allow them to invest in healthcare to improve the household nutrition, or invest in education to send their kids to school. Microfinancing essentially equips the poor with tools to reduce their own vulnerability to problems that perpetuate poverty. So how does microfinancing work in Cambodia? Microfinancing actually started in Cambodia in the early 90s with the arrival of the United Nations Transitional Authority in Cambodia. And it had a legion of peacekeepers and donors and foreign advisors and NGOs. And the projects that were set up at that point were envisioned to be short-term reconstruction projects. And many of them included an integrated credit component where people would be given loans. For example, Akleta Bank, which is actually one of the biggest microfinance institutions in Cambodia now, started as a small business development and vocational education program for demobilized soldiers. The goal at that point was to enable this specific group of poor Cambodians to take advantage of economic opportunities through an integrated package of business development, training, and credit. And the important thing to notice about this period in microfinancing was that it was specifically targeted at poor populations, and it combined these non-financial services like vocational education, healthcare, and literacy classes with access to credit in one package. Soon after microfinancing started to get a foothold in Cambodia, the landscape really started to change because the government really wanted to start establishing a financial, stable financial sector. And microfinancing in the year 1999 already had about $23 million worth of microloan portfolio, and they were serving about 14% of the households in Cambodia, which is amazing. Banking officials at that point knew that microfinancing was something really important, and so they gathered international donors, government officials, and microcredit providers to figure out a regulatory regime that would allow for microfinancing to grow. What resulted from these negotiations was an amazingly revolutionary piece of legislation called the Law on Microfinance Institutions and Specialized Banks. It contained a tiered licensing system for microfinancing institutions, which I'll just start calling MFIs from now on. The tiers were registered MFIs, licensed MFIs, and then specialized banks at the top. And as you move up this tiered system, the regulations grew increasingly rigorous. So, for example, registered MFIs have lower capital and reserve requirements than licensed MFIs, and licensed MFIs have less stringent reporting requirements than specialized banks. So basically, the more money you were dealing with, the more supervision you had. The upshot of this new law was that it forced institutions to focus on either developmental activities in Cambodia or to really focus on providing financial services. Because once you were loaning a certain amount of money, you were required to register or else you'd be operating illegally. So NGOs that began to climb this ladder up to becoming more and more bank-like maintained their social mission to the poor. But while they were doing this, they shed a lot of those non-financial kind of services that they had originally provided as NGOs. For example, one of the organizations I talked to, World Relief, started in Cambodia, and they were delivering health, hygiene, nutrition lessons, and they also had an integrated credit component. But now the credit component exists by itself as a microfinance institution that is licensed, and they don't have those other classes anymore. There are certainly some NGOs that have chosen to stay development-focused and still do offer these services, but now what we see is that these financial services are completely separated from the non-financial services. And the problem with this is that many studies have shown that, at least for the very poor, microfinance services alone are not successful at alleviating poverty. You need to equip these people with literacy skills, numeracy skills, training them in poultry rearing, basic healthcare services, in order for them to work themselves out of poverty. If you look at financial indicators, MFIs in Cambodia look amazing. The repayment rates range from 80 to 95%. Most of the MFIs that I talked to indicated that around 80% or more of their clients were women. And so if you look at these numbers, it seems pretty rosy, but they don't tell the entire story. The separation of these non-financial services from financial products wouldn't be so bad if MFIs were actually monitoring by social indicators, but none of them do that. Every microfinance institution I talked to, I was like, well, so does this impact health? Are they sending their kids to school? And no one knew. They just have no monitoring in that way. They kind of operate on this logic that, well, you know, these clients are still taking out loans, they're returning for more loan cycles, they're taking out bigger loans, and they're repaying them. So it must be working. And there's a whole range of reasons for the lack of social monitoring. First and foremost, lack of resources in terms of human capital and actual capital. And they don't have standards by which to actually measure the impact on health and nutrition or education. So there are these social services that are offered by NGOs who have opted out of this tiered system, but they're generally on a small scale, and they generally cater to specific groups like people living with HIV or trafficked girls. MFIs, on the other hand, cover a much larger portion of the country, and they're only offering financial services. So it remains unclear whether there are significant populations that have a need that are not being met, and it's hard to really figure that out because no one's monitoring. There are some interesting innovations, networks in particular, between MFIs and NGOs. One group I talked to was Vision Fund, an MFI, and they had a network with Kana, which is kind of an NGO dedicated to access to healthcare for people living with HIV/AIDS, and Kana basically puts together a group of people that they know who are living with HIV and need access to funding, and Vision Fund provides the money. And it's a pilot project right now, but they're trying to figure out what type of loan product is responsive to the needs of people who are living with HIV. So in conclusion, while we have a general conception that there's this really intimate link between microfinancing and human rights, where access to financing in some way liberates poor people and empowers them to manage household consumption and build assets, my inquiry is whether or not this logic is actually the reality in Cambodia. The laws are great, financial system looks great, but does the current organization of these MFIs and these NGOs, where non-financial services are not delivered with the financial product, is it leaving behind portions of the population that really need it? So that's microfinancing in Cambodia. Next up, Kathleen Jury.
Hi, I'm Kathleen. My research focuses on the right of education for indigenous Cambodians, and I've specifically looked at the right of education that is culturally sensitive to their needs as well as in their native language. And before going into some of the legal and policy issues that bear on this, I thought it might be helpful to give a little bit of background on the indigenous peoples of Cambodia. There are at least a dozen distinct groups, even though they represent less than 2% of the population. And the vast majority of them live in the remote northeastern provinces of Ratanakiri and Mondulkiri. And the communities straddle the border between Laos and Vietnam. So they're not strictly related to the Khmer majority any more than they are related to Vietnamese or Laotian people. So I did my research among the Krung and the Tempuan, who live in Ratanakiri, and they're the two largest indigenous groups in Cambodia. And I visited 8 villages for my research. Ratanakiri is a very, very remote area of Cambodia. The only way to get there is by a 12-hour bus ride on many dirt roads, and you can really only get there practically in the dry season. And this has had some good effects on the indigenous population. Because it is so remote, they've been sort of left alone and sort of not as affected by a lot of the tumultuous history of the country. However, it also means that they don't get a lot of services that the rest of the Cambodians do, and they've pretty much been neglected by the Cambodian government or sort of condescendingly tolerated. And just as an example of some of the numbers to go along with this, a 2000 study showed that only 5% of indigenous males were functionally literate, and that's compared to 47% at the time of regular Cambodians. And the study, the researchers cannot find a single indigenous woman that they determined was functionally literate. And so I wanted to investigate two things when I went to this area. One was the extent to which the education is comparable among indigenous peoples to the regular Cambodian majority. And this is based on, of course, the treaties, there are several conventions, rather, that Cambodia is a signatory to that guarantee access to primary education, to free primary education for all citizens. And in addition, this education is meant to be provided in a non-discriminatory manner. So I wanted to look at basically comparing the several factors, the facilities, the materials, the teachers, the curriculum of the indigenous population with the majority to determine whether, like, obviously we know that the level of education, even among the Khmer majority, is not going to be the level of facilities that you get in the United States, but I wanted to at least see if the indigenous people were getting that minimum standard that the rest of the country is getting. In addition, I wanted to see to what extent the Cambodian government was providing education that was language-based and culturally based to be effective for the indigenous population. So I based this kind of argument for a right to this kind of education on the provisions in the Convention on the Right of the Child that says that a child has a right to their cultural identity. In addition, Cambodia recently signed the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which contains an article precisely mandating language-based education and education that is culturally sensitive to traditional indigenous institutions. And what I found, of course, which you might suspect, is that Cambodia has just completely ignored these mandates. There are no government bilingual schools. The facilities in the provinces are far inferior to even the marginal facilities that exist in Phnom Penh and other rural areas of Cambodia. Most of the school buildings consisted of little more than just a building with a single blackboard. There weren't even any desks for the students to sit at. And this is in contrast to Phnom Penh, where they at least have like visual aids, they have desks, they have playgrounds, they have computers in some instances, and none of these things are provided in the areas of Ratanakiri. Another problem is that attendance is extremely poor in amongst the indigenous population, and this is to a large extent due to the fact that the Cambodian government fails to take account of lifestyles of these people. For instance, they don't acknowledge the fact that they're based on a subsistence economy, and the children are required for survival to help their families in farming, in gathering materials. They also learn, that's how they learn how to, the skills that they need to survive is by watching their parents and observing with their parents how to do these things. And school basically takes away from this time. And many of the parents and elders that I talked to in the villages expressed concern about this, that they need the children for survival, and they are worried that what they're learning in the schools is not useful to the communities, that they're just learning about Khmer culture and the majority culture, and they're not, they're all like fleeing the villages because, you know, there's nothing for them there. And so one of the NGOs that I talked with, Care Cambodia, has launched this pilot program for bilingual schools. In addition to being bilingual, they're also culturally sensitive by scheduling classes that are sensitive to the needs of the subsistence lifestyle, by teaching subjects that are useful to the students, like how to identify various plants that have medicinal purposes, education on reproduction and neonatal care for girls, these kind of things that can be incorporated into teaching literacy and math and all the other things that they learn in school. And attendance on these schools has been up to 3 times better than at government schools, which shows that the communities are invested in these types of education, and it does help, and it's a way for the government to kind of make up for the lack of attention that has been done in the past. So in my paper, I just conclude by arguing that the government can model its government schools on these NGO pilot schools. And there are, obviously Cambodia has limited funding and things like that, but there are cost-effective ways of doing that. And I list just a bunch of them, which I won't go into because we're running out of time. But there is a blueprint for these schools, and it's up to the Cambodian government. They're required by these conventions to do something about this, and they can use these blueprints to go forward.
The Khmer Rouge killed between 1.7 and 3 million people under the dictatorship of Pol Pot and his cadre. This happened in less than 4 years, between 1975 and 1979. The number of the dead represents about a quarter of the Cambodian population at that time. The current Prime Minister, Hun Sen, who's backed by the Vietnamese and came to power after the Vietnamese occupation and civil war, he himself is a former member of the Khmer Rouge, and he has negotiated on behalf of the Cambodian government with the United Nations to set up the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. It's a mixed or hybrid tribunal. What that means is that it exists as a matter of Cambodian law, but it applies both Cambodian criminal and international criminal, humanitarian, and human rights law, including, for example, the 1949 Genocide Convention and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as the types of crimes that are defined under the Rome Statute. As I mentioned, it functions as an organ of Cambodian law, but it includes significant involvement from international staff, international investment, funding, international sort of de facto control over the day-to-day activities of the court. The Cambodian judges make up a simple majority, and the international judges make up a minority of the staff on the court, but any decision that the court makes requires a supermajority. The court is officially known as the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, or ECCC, and under the law on the ECCC, the tribunal has jurisdiction to prosecute senior members of the Khmer Rouge or those most responsible for the crimes of that regime. This grant of jurisdiction only extends to the time in which the Khmer Rouge had absolute power in Cambodia, from April 1975 to January 1979. Under this formulation, there are currently only five defendants facing prosecution at the Khmer Rouge, and this includes Doik, who's the leader of the notorious S21 prison, which you heard about briefly. This is where enemies of the regime were taken to be systematically tortured before they were taken to the killing fields to be extrajudicially murdered and buried in mass graves. We visited the killing fields and saw many of these graves excavated. We saw bone fragments still in the dirt, clothing from the victims. We visited, as you heard before from Robin, I believe, that we visited the S21 prison, now known as the Tuol Sleng Genocide Museum, which is in the heart of Phnom Penh, where we saw photographs of hundreds of the 17,000 victims. We saw blood stains on the walls and the floors of the rooms there, the torture chambers. We saw the cells of the prisoners there and the implements of torture used against them, including a waterboarding table. Although Doik controlled this most famous of approximately 400 prisons of the Khmer Rouge, he was not a senior leader. So he's being prosecuted under the formulation of those most responsible for the crimes of the Khmer Rouge. And he himself has confessed in court to his responsibility for these crimes. He's apologized. He's asked forgiveness from the 12 remaining survivors of the prison itself, as well as from the souls of the dead. And he's cooperating with the prosecution and providing the court and, you know, thereby the public at large with a more full understanding of the functioning of the Khmer Rouge. The four other defendants include brother number two, Nguyen Chea, Foreign Minister Ieng Seri, his wife, Ieng Thirith, who was the Minister of Social Action, the head of state, Khieu Sam Phan. These defendants are all in their early 80s or late 70s. Many have had significant health problems. They're given competent medical treatment as a condition of their pretrial detention, of which many have been in detention for several years. Doik, for example, has been in detention for more than 9 years now. And his trial just began last week. I focus primarily on civil party participation in the Khmer Rouge. So although these are criminal prosecutions, victims of the Khmer Rouge have the right to participate in the proceedings as civil parties. The purpose of this rule is to allow them the chance to participate, to serve a sort of truth and reconciliation function, to allow victims to come forward and tell their stories, to allow their stories to be heard by an official body. And also to allow victims to seek moral and collective reparations from the defendants. The court can order those types of reparations, but the court has made a decision not to allow civil parties to seek individual money damages. There have been significant problems with civil party participation. These include availability of adequate representation, meaning the competence of the lawyers who are representing civil parties, issues of individual versus class representation, including the resulting issues of administrability before the court, availability of adequate remedies for the victims, and lack of effective court outreach to the victims to inform them of their rights. And you can see this in this graphical representation here. This is the court building right here. The court address officially says that it's in Phnom Penh, It's not. It's actually in Chom Chau province, which is about a 45-minute tuk-tuk ride from Phnom Penh. And it's very, very difficult for Cambodians, not only in Phnom Penh, but throughout the country, to access the court building and really to get any information at all about the court's proceedings. And when you question court officials about this, about their outreach efforts, they say, well, did you see the website? Internet penetration in Cambodia is approximately 6%, so no, we didn't see the website. Now, in the DOIC proceedings, there are approximately 500 people going to the court every day to hear the proceedings, to be in the court chambers, to be in ancillary rooms where you have live video feeds. So people are actually getting out to the court. But again, these trips to the court are primarily scheduled with bus trips that you have to register for on the court's website. So again, it's really a select few that truly have access to participate as audience members in these proceedings, and even fewer who have access to participate as civil parties. For example, there were 17,000 victims of the S21 prison, but there are only 169 civil parties in the DOIC proceeding, even though 17,000 families lost members to his crimes. Moreover, I mean, this court is really the one chance that civil parties in Cambodia will ever have to bring claims against leaders of the Khmer Rouge. There's really only going to be one bite at the apple. When the court is finished with its prosecutions, it will automatically dissolve. And there's currently a dispute amongst the Cambodian and international co-prosecutors about whether or not to bring further indictments, so which is likely to remain unresolved for some time, I think. So right now, really, not only do you have to, have adequate representation to file your claim, but you can only really file a claim against the current five defendants, and you have to somehow establish that the harm you suffered was related to their orders or their aiding and abetting or some decision that they made. You have to show imputation to these particular defendants in order to, presumably, in order to succeed on your claim. No trial has actually come to its resolution yet. Another complication is that any resolution of a civil claim against these defendants cannot contradict the result of their conviction or acquittal in the criminal proceeding. So unlike in the American context, for example, I mean, think of O.J. Simpson as the most famous example of this. He was acquitted on the criminal charges but then lost the civil claim against him. That is not going to be able to happen in the Khmer Rouge tribunal. So therefore, I question the court's ability to achieve justice broadly. Really, only those civil parties who are directly participating in the process are going to achieve any measure of justice, if at all. And those who are left outside of the confines of this court proceeding are not going to have any real opportunity to pursue legitimate claims for the harm suffered under this regime. And therefore, I'm not very optimistic about the court's ability to function as a true kind of truth or reconciliation commission and really bring the kind of closure and fairness and sense of justice that I think is really desperately needed to heal this deeply, deeply traumatized society. Thank you.
Dave's going to fix our, oh no, sorry. I don't know what happened to our projector here, but I'm last, and I promise to be brief, so we can wrap this up. My research, I had a nice picture of a lovely disabled Cambodian volleyball player who's on the award-winning national Cambodian disabled volleyball team. But my research is on the legal rights of the disabled and specifically Cambodia's compliance with the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Cambodia is believed to have one of the highest rates of disability in the world. There aren't any reliable statistics, but some people have estimated it to be as high as 21%, which is well above the world average of 10%. There are many reasons for this statistic, probably the biggest of which is just poverty. Poverty is a major cause and also a consequence of disability, and 36% of Cambodians live in poverty right now. Other contributing factors to the high prevalence of disability include birth defects, disease, particularly polio,
just Cambodia's history of conflict and war and unexploded ordnance or landmines that are still in the country. And also, surprisingly, Cambodia has just a huge ton of motorcycle crashes each year. So there are a lot of head injuries that have contributed to the rate of disability. People with disabilities face a lot of problems in Cambodia. They have essentially no explicit legal protection, and some of the existing laws actually directly discriminate against people with disability. For example, certain categories of people with disabilities, including impotent men and people with uncured cancer or tuberculosis or venereal disease, and people who are considered to have a mental defect or are considered insane, they're all prohibited from marrying under the marriage and family law. And also the government-issued recruitment criteria for teachers requires that they be free from disability. So in addition to these directly discriminatory laws, there are no existing laws in Cambodia's disability rights scheme that ensure protection for people with disabilities. There are no legal provisions for accessibility, including communication accessibility to accommodate the blind, the deaf, or the mute. And there are also no legal provisions to protect against the human rights violations that can ensue from the use of legal incapacitation against people with mental disabilities. And finally, people with disabilities are explicitly excluded from the non-discrimination clause under the labor law, which significantly hinders their ability to find work and provide for themselves and their families. In addition to a lack of legal protection, Cambodians with disabilities also face cultural and societal obstacles. Stigma and discrimination are profuse and are magnified by the pervasive belief in karma, one of the tenets of Buddhism, which is the faith followed by about 95% of Cambodians. Karma is part of the Buddhist theory of moral responsibility, where the effect of a deed is not determined solely by the deed itself, but also by the nature and intention of the person who commits the deed and the circumstances in which it is committed. Because of this deep-rooted belief in karma, many Cambodians believe that people with disabilities have done something in a previous life to deserve their disability. So this conviction is widespread, and people with visible impairments aren't allowed in most public places. They're not allowed in temples, so they can't actually practice their Buddhist faith if they are Buddhist. I met with one man, a Cambodian man named Sarath, who works for the Cambodian Disabled People's Organization, and he has a prosthetic leg that he's had for decades after a childhood battle with polio. And I told him that I was studying law, and he told me that his childhood dream had been to be a lawyer because he wanted to be an advocate for others with disabilities because they had no voice in Cambodia. He was rejected from every law school to which he applied because there's a requirement that applicants be sound in mind and body. And this is actually still a requirement today. So in 2007, Cambodia signed the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities and the Optional Protocol. They haven't yet ratified them. Cambodia has also been working on a draft domestic disability law, and they've been working on this law for about 12 years. And so they have quite a bit of momentum worked up in terms of just all of the effort that's gone into it in terms of getting it passed. And actually, at the very end of 2008, so right before we got there, a politician, a member of the National Assembly, made a public speech and actually mentioned the draft law and mentioned that it was a priority for him to get it passed. So the NGO community is really excited, and they think that after 12 years, 2009 might be the year when this law actually gets passed. So the problem is, though, that while this law would give a significant amount of legal protection to people with disabilities, it's not in compliance with the UN Convention, which Cambodia just signed. So the issue that Cambodia is now facing is whether they should go ahead and pass this law that they've worked so hard on for so many years and that is essentially about to be passed, or whether they should kind of stop the momentum that they have going and try to amend the law to make it fully comply with the UN Convention, and then they could ratify the convention and have the domestic law that was in compliance. So all of the NGOs that I talked to in Cambodia really, really did not want to have to do that. They thought if the if the draft law had to be amended and kind of the ball had to be stopped and they couldn't push forward to get this draft law passed this year, that the momentum was just going to be gone and nobody would have the strength or the energy to kind of start all over. Not to mention that there would be potentially 12 more years or more where people with disabilities in Cambodia had essentially no legal protection. So that's on the one hand, you know, do they just kind of stay the course and continue on with this draft law and pass it and then try to amend it later to bring it into compliance with the UN Convention? And so that's one option. The other option from the international standpoint would be to amend the law right now, ratify the convention, try to bring the country into full compliance with the UN, with the international standard that's outlined in the UN Convention, and the hope would be eventually the legal protections for people with disabilities would be greater because they could, you know, do it right the first time. And I think there is a lot to be said for not having to go back over something you've just done and fix it, essentially. So it's also a political problem, you know, is if they kind of pressure the legislature to pass this law and then they immediately have to tell the legislature, oh, I'm sorry, now we need to amend that law that you just passed. You know, that's probably problematic. So you can see that, you know, neither of these options is great. And I'm still actually undecided on where I come down on this. I think no matter what Cambodia does, it's going to be a struggle. And I would really like to be able to say that I think Cambodia should, you know, just do whatever they need to do to get a law passed now, to get at least some basic minimal level of protection, legal protection for people with disabilities. But at the same time, you know, you have to think, is that going to hinder their ability to give them full protection in the long run? So I'll let you know in 2 months when I make my decision. So regardless of what Cambodia does decide to do, I think the most important thing is just for the government to pick just a path, regardless of what that path is, and commit to it. So I'm going to sit down now, and we'd like to open it up for questions that you all might have for any of us.